Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're diving into a period that, well, it feels like history, but it's casting a long shadow over everything happening right now. We're talking about the Cold War.
That's right. And we're using Robert J. McMahon's fantastic short book, The Cold War, a very short introduction, as our guide.
It's easy to think of the Cold War as, you know, black and white photos, Berlin Wall, maybe some old spy movies.
Yeah, dusty archives.
Exactly. But you look around today, you look at NATO's role, you look at U.S.-China tensions, conflicts in places like Ukraine. It's all connected back.
It absolutely is. The dynamics are still playing out. So the goal here isn't just a history lesson like dates and names.
Right.
It's about getting past that simple East versus West picture. McMahon really pushes us to see it as this messy global thing, full of misunderstandings, frankly.
So understanding how it worked is key to understanding today.
Pretty much. It's like the blueprint, you know, for how major powers interact, the role of ideology, the security fears. It's all in there. It laid down the DNA for modern geopolitics.
Okay, so let's talk about the author guiding us through this, Robert J. McMahon. Who is he?
Well, he's a really well-respected American historian, professor emeritus at Ohio State, big focus on U.S. foreign relations, especially during the Cold War.
So he knows his stuff, but what makes his take on it special? You mentioned his perspective is distinctive.
Yeah, that's important. He's considered part of the post-revisionist school of thought.
Okay, post-revisionist. Sounds a bit academic, maybe. What does that actually mean for us trying to understand the Cold War?
It's crucial, actually. It's about why the Cold War happened. You know, the first wave, the orthodox view, basically blamed the Soviets. Aggression, expansion, all that.
Okay.
Then the revisionists came along, especially during the Vietnam era, and said, hold on, maybe the U.S. was the problem. Economic expansion provoking the Soviets.
So they flipped the blame.
Exactly. The post-revisionists, like McMahon, they kind of step back and say, look, it's not that simple. It wasn't just one side's fault.
So it's more complicated.
Much more. He emphasizes mutual misunderstandings. And this key idea, the security dilemma.
The security dilemma. Explain that a bit.
It's basically when one country takes steps to make itself feel more secure, say the USSR setting up friendly governments in Eastern Europe after being invaded twice.
The defensive buffer zone, from their view.
Right. But the other side, the US in this case, sees those same actions as aggressive, as offensive, as proof the other side is trying to expand.
So defensive moves look like offensive threats, and it just spirals.
Precisely. It's a cycle of suspicion. Fear becomes the engine, maybe even more than ideology sometimes. And McMahon's background, particularly his work on U.S. involvement in Asia, means he doesn't just focus on Europe. He brings in the global picture, especially the developing world.
That makes sense. Okay, so let's get into the book's main argument then. It's not just U.S. versus USSR.
No, definitely not. McMahon paints it as this volatile mix. You've got the deep ideological clash capitalism versus communism, sure. But also old-fashioned power politics, security fears, national interests, and like we said, those huge misperceptions.
And it wasn't just the superpowers dictating everything.
That's a key insight. Often local dynamics, what was happening in Korea or Vietnam or Cuba, pulled the superpowers in. It wasn't always Washington or Moscow calling all the shots from the start. Local actors had agency.
Okay, so the book covers the whole sweep. From the end of World War II.
Yeah, right from the uneasy alliance at Yalta and Potsdam, through all the crises, Berlin, Cuba, Vietnam, right up to the fall of the Soviet Union in 91. It's about 45 years.
And it's meant for anyone who wants a solid, but not overly simplistic understanding of this massive chunk of modern history.
Exactly. McMahon argues you kind of have to get a grip on these Cold War dynamics to make sense of today's world. Current conflicts, alliances like NATO, power shifts, the roots are here.
All right, let's trace that history. Where does McMahon say it all began? The spark.
He calls the origin, roughly 41 to 47, a perfect storm. The alliance against Hitler. Pure convenience. Underneath, there was this fundamental, irreconcilable ideological divide. American liberal democracy and capitalism versus Soviet Marxism-Leninism. They genuinely believed the other system had to fail.
And that tension flared up almost immediately after the war ended, right? At the conferences, Yalta, Potsdam.
Big time. Huge disagreements over Poland, over what to do with Germany, and then Soviet actions in Eastern Europe setting up those satellite states. That was the first major flashpoint.
The West saw it as pure expansionism, Stalin-grabbing territory.
And absolutely. That's how it looked from Washington and London. But McMahon reminds us, from Moscow's view, after Napoleon, after Hitler, they desperately wanted that buffer zone. It felt defensive to them.
Fear again, leading to the Iron Curtain speech and George Kennan's long telegram.
Which shapes U.S. policy into containment, the idea that Soviet expansion had to be resisted, contained wherever it popped up.
So by 47, containment becomes official policy. And things start to harden, right? Yeah. Up to about 53.
Yeah, the structures solidify. Think about the Marshall Plan. We often hear about it as, you know, generous economic aid.
Helping rebuild Europe.
Which it did. But McMahon frames it as strategically brilliant. It stabilized Western economies, sure, but it also tied them tightly to the U.S. and made communism look less attractive internally. A masterstroke, really.
And then the first real confrontation. Berlin.
The Berlin blockade and airlift, yeah. That directly led to the formal division of Germany. Two separate states, East and West, solidifying the divide.
And that divide becomes military pretty quickly.
Very quickly. You get NATO formed in 1949, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. A defensive pact, basically, under the American nuclear umbrella.
And the Soviets respond later with their own alliance.
Yep, the Warsaw Pact in 1955. So now you have these two armed camps facing off.
But McMahon points to a specific event that really globalized and militarized this whole thing, doesn't he?
He does. The Korean War, 1950 to 53, that was the pivot. Before Korea, containment was maybe a bit more selective, more political or economic. After Korea starts, the U.S. leadership becomes convinced that communism is this single, monolithic force, directed by Moscow, aiming for world domination and needing a military response everywhere.
So Korea flips the switch from selective containment to a global military strategy.
Pretty much. It unlocks massive defense spending, NSC 68, all of that. And it sets the stage for the most dangerous phase, the brinkmanship years.
Right. From about 53 to 62, this is the peak nuclear tension period.
Absolutely. The arms race kicks into high gear. You get concepts like massive retaliation.
Which sounds terrifying. What did it actually mean in practice?
It was John Foster Dulles, Eisenhower's Secretary of State. The idea was the U.S. would respond to any Soviet aggression, even small-scale conventional stuff, with a full-on nuclear attack on the USSR.
Wow. Using the threat of total annihilation as deterrence for anything.
Essentially, yes. Deterrence through, well, seeming potentially irrational. The stakes were planetary. Mm-hmm. And then comes Sputnik in 57.
Right. The Soviet satellite. That caused panic in the U.S.
Huge panic, the missile gap fear. Are the Soviets ahead? Can they launch nukes at us easily? All that anxiety builds and builds.
And culminates in Cuba.
The Cuban Missile Crisis, October 1962. McMahon really highlights this as the moment humanity stared into the abyss. 13 days where miscalculation could have meant nuclear war.
It was chilling to think about. But the crisis had a consequence, right? It kind of scared both sides straight.
It absolutely did. It was so terrifyingly close that it forced a degree of caution, led directly to the Moscow-Washington hotline, the red phone, so leaders could talk directly in a crisis, and the Limited Test Ban Treaty in 63, banning atmospheric nuclear tests. A small step, but significant.
So direct superpower war becomes almost unthinkable because of nukes, which shifts the conflict.
Exactly. It shifts to the Third World, as it was called then. This is central to McMahon's argument. The global South, Asia, Africa, Latin America became the main battlefield.
This is where the Cold War got very hot.
Tragically hot. While Washington and Moscow avoided direct conflict, their proxy wars killed millions. And this is where decolonization gets tangled up in it all.
How did that happen? These newly independent nations just trying to find their feet?
Well, the superpowers didn't really see them as independent actors with their own histories and goals. They saw them as potential chess pieces. Are they pro-West or pro-Soviet? That was the main question.
So ideology trumped local realities.
Often, yes. The U.S. ended up backing a lot of anti-communist dictators just because they weren't communist. Think Iran in 53, Guatemala in 54, later Chile. The USSR backed revolutionary movements, sometimes regardless of their democratic credentials. Both sides often sacrificed local aspirations for strategic gain.
And Vietnam is the ultimate example of this tragic misreading.
It's the poster child, really. McMahon argues the U.S., blinded by the domino theory, the idea that if one country falls to communism, the next will too.
Like dominoes falling in a line.
Exactly. They saw Ho Chi Minh not as a Vietnamese nationalist first, fighting against French colonialism and then for reunification, but primarily as a pawn of Moscow and Beijing.
A fundamental misread of a local situation.
A catastrophic one. The war, the costs, the failure. It shattered the American consensus about intervening abroad in the name of fighting communism.
Okay, so Vietnam shakes things up. There's a period of détente, the relaxation of tensions in the 70s, but that doesn't last?
No, it collapses. The key event McMahon points to is the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. That really killed détente.
And leads to what's sometimes called the Second Cold War.
Right. Enter Ronald Reagan. He takes a much harder line, calls the USSR the evil empire, ramps up military spending dramatically, pushes for SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars.
A space-based missile defense system.
Right.
Which seemed technologically far-fetched, but...
But it put immense pressure on the Soviets. They knew they couldn't keep up economically with that kind of technological arms race. Their system was already creaking.
Which brings us to the man McMahon sees as absolutely pivotal in ending it all.
Mikhail Gorbachev takes power in 1985. McMahon argues he's the indispensable figure.
Why? What did he do?
He introduced reforms glasnost, which meant political openness, allowing criticism and debate.
And perestroika.
Economic restructuring. Trying to make the Soviet economy more efficient, more dynamic. His goal was actually to save the Soviet system, to revitalize it.
But it didn't quite work out that way.
No. Glasnost opened the floodgates. People started demanding more changes. National groups pushed for independence. And the crucial thing, the absolute game changer, was Gorbachev's decision in 1989.
What was that?
He refused to use military force to crush the pro-democracy movement sweeping across Eastern Europe. Unlike previous Soviet leaders in Hungary 56 or Czechoslovakia 68.
He let them go.
He let them go. That refusal to roll the tanks, allow the Berlin Wall to fall peacefully, allowed Czechoslovakia's Velvet Revolution, Poland's Solidarity Movement to succeed. It wasn't Reagan winning militarily, it was the Soviet system crumbling from within, and Gorbachev choosing not to prop it up with violence.
And that leads directly to the dissolution of the Soviet Union itself in 1991.
Exactly. Economic exhaustion combined with Gorbachev's choices. That's McMahon's take on the end.
Okay, quite a journey. Let's distill some of the big takeaways. What are the core themes McMahon wants us to remember? Theme one seems to be this constant tension, ideology versus real politics.
Yeah, it was both things at once, wasn't it? A fight over ideas, over which system was better or more just, historically destined to win, but also just a classic great power rivalry, national interests, spheres of influence, security.
And that mix is dangerous.
Extremely. When you're convinced your side is 100% right, morally superior, compromise feels like betrayal, it leads to that zero-sum thinking. If they gain, we lose. You can see echoes of that in political polarization today, maybe.
Definitely. Okay, theme two. The global South paid the price.
This is so crucial to McMahon's argument. We have to stop seeing the Cold War as just a Washington-Moscow affair. The actual fighting, the deaths, the devastation millions suffered in Korea, Vietnam, Angola, Afghanistan, Central America, they bore the brunt of the superpower contest.
Decentering the narrative is key. Theme three. The nuclear paradox.
Right. The existence of nuclear weapons created this bizarre situation. Mutually assured destruction, MAD, meant all-out war was suicidal.
So it created a kind of stability, a long peace in Europe, as some call it.
A terrifying stability, yeah. But it also held the world hostage, fueled an incredibly expensive arms race, and didn't prevent those brutal proxy wars elsewhere. It's a paradox we still live with.
And theme four, economics mattered a lot.
Ultimately, yes. It was a battle of systems, and the Soviet command economy just couldn't sustain the competition long term. Especially not the military spending and providing a decent standard of living. The dynamism of the Western capitalist economies, flaws and all, proved more resilient. Economic weakness was a fundamental reason the USSR collapsed.
McMahon has some really concise ways of summing up these complex ideas.
Yeah.
You pull out a few key statements.
Yeah, they really capture his balanced post-revisionist view. The first one gets right at that security dilemma idea.
Let's hear it.
He basically says, the Cold War was not the result of a single act of aggression, but rather the product of a tragic, escalating cycle of mutual suspicion, where the defensive maneuvers of one superpower were invariably seen as offensive threats by the other.
Tragic cycle of mutual suspicion. That captures it well. And the one about the victims.
This one really hammers home the global cost. While leaders in Washington and Moscow waged a Cold War, the conflict's hottest and most devastating battles were fought by proxies in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. making the Third World the primary victim of the superpower struggle.
Really shifts the focus. And finally, his take on how it ended.
Yeah, he pushes back against a simple West won narrative. The end of bewildered Cold War was less a triumphant victory for the West and more a collapse from within for the Soviet Union, brought on by systemic economic decay and the courageous decision of one leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, to refuse to use force.
Collapse from within, enabled by a leader's choice. Okay, so bringing this all home, how can we use these insights today? What are the real-life applications?
Well, first, just understanding current geopolitics, like you mentioned earlier, U.S.-China rivalry. You can analyze it using some of these Cold War lenses, ideological competitions, security fears, alliance building.
And understanding NATO's origins and expansion helps explain current tensions with Russia, for example.
Absolutely. You have to know the history. Second application, the danger of that ideological certainty, that us versus them mentality.
Seeing the other side is purely evil or irrational.
Right. The Cold War shows how that makes compromise impossible and escalation almost inevitable. It's a huge cautionary tale for political division everywhere, I think.
Third,
recognizing the limits of power. Vietnam is the big lesson here, isn't it? Just because you have more money and better weapons doesn't mean you'll win against determined nationalism or local forces you don't understand. It calls for caution about intervention.
Good point. And the last one.
Maybe the most important on a human level, the value of perspective taking. McMahon's whole emphasis on mutual misperception. It screams that you have to try and see the world from your rival's point of view. Understand their fears, their security concerns, even if you don't agree with them. It's essential for dialing things back, whether it's a global crisis or just a disagreement at work.
That's a great takeaway. For me, reflecting on this, what really jumped out was how McMahon shows the agency of smaller nations, Cuba, Vietnam, Egypt. They weren't just puppets. People like Castro, Ho Chi Minh, Nasser, they skillfully played the superpowers off each other to achieve their own goals. It complicates that simple bipolar story.
Yeah, it absolutely does. They were actors in their own right. My final thought is just how deeply embedded the Cold War legacy is. It's not over, in a sense. The institutions it created, the alliances, the nuclear dangers, the North-South divides, the democracy versus autocracy framing, it's all still shaping our world. Understanding it isn't just history, it's, well, essential for being an informed citizen today. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.